This week on the show, CIL My Landlord, Donuts, Pecans, and Rebels. All this and more on This Week in Media. Hello, boys and girls, children of all ages. Good God, I hate that intro. I have with me today a really, really great cast of not at all the usual suspects, and we're going to have kind of an interesting show today. We're going to talk about what I and John Foster refer to as Rebels.
That's right, Rebels.
In the spirit of The Rebel Guide to Filmmaking, in the spirit of Rebels on the Backlot, in the spirit of everything Rebel. So today, as I alluded to, I have with me kind of an old timer to twit, somebody who's been around for a while, John Foster.
I actually haven't been on the show for a while, and I haven't edited it since the 84th episode.
Excellent. So. I believe that episode was referred to as the Jump the Shark episode, according to the forums.
Really? I don't know. That was the last one that I did. I was on the show a few more times after that, but that was it.
Excellent. Well, I think we've course corrected since then, hopefully. So I have also on the show someone who's never been on it, which is Mark Christensen.
Hey, how's it going?
It's going really well. Mark, as you probably know, is the author of the tome of After Effects. I believe it's called After Effects Studio Techniques.
Studio Techniques is the series name, yeah.
It's called After Effects The Good. It's the great tome of Christensen. We all love it. I have also with me someone else new to the show, Lucas Martell. Lucas is the creator of the phenomenally cool and interesting video podcast, Pigeon Impossible. Hey, Lucas.
Hey, how's it going, guys? I don't know that I've quite achieved tome status yet, but hopefully someday.
I also have with me someone else new to the show, so I guess we have a lot of couple of old faces and a lot of new ones. We have Paul Del Vecchio. I hope I am pronouncing your last name correct, Paul.
Yeah, that's right.
Excellent. Paul is, if you watch that media show or you're generally familiar with things on the internet that relate to new media, you'll know that Paul is one of the guys who submitted and I believe is on the DVD for the Diary of the Dead George Romero contest.
Yeah, we submitted and we won the grand prize for that. And I want to add that actually that film is a complete Rebel film. I mean, we shot it with no money and we did it in like 2 days.
Excellent. So, yeah, well, we'll definitely dig into that. That's exciting. So like I say, this show is going to be a little bit different. We might talk about a few things that have happened in the last week, but only insofar as they relate to us. So here we go. So the idea here is we're going to talk a little bit of a kind of an Algonquin roundtable style here and talk about how each and every one of us creates media and how, you know, the issues that we face and sort of the things that we run into. And John Foster and I have actually discussed this at length. And the first question I would like to ask my panel of distinguished guests is, how did you get here? Like, and let's start with you, John. What got you into this?
We're not extinguished guests.
Yeah, extinguished.
Extinguished. I started I needed to reset my career. I was in software development, and I was looking at software development. And was like, well, this is really hard. I'm approaching 30 years old, and I need something that's and as everyone knows, if you haven't made your program, if you haven't done your engineering by 30, you're done. It's a kid's sport, programming. So I said, well, I'm going to go and come up with a different tack, and that was media development. At the time, QuickTime was coming out, and CD-ROMs were coming out. So everyone was going to get rich off of putting media onto CD-ROMs, whether it was an encyclopedia or a tome about birds or whatever it was. This was the thing. And along the way, we find out that that kind of media development is no different than, say, making a movie or doing audio recording or any of those things. And I didn't know that. I just got into it just because I thought it was cool. And I was able to take my programming skills and move them forward.
Yeah, so you and I are pretty similar in that way. We both come from – I like to describe myself as a recovering technologist. We both come from that world. That brings me to – there's an interesting question that I really wanted to ask on the two-year anniversary episode of TWIM that we didn't get a chance to ask, which is And I think I would ask this of everyone. How has the world changed in the last 2 years? I mean, if you look at, you know, you talk about CD-ROMs. Yeah. When TWiM first started, there weren't television shows in iTunes. I mean, that was an announcement that happened along the way.
Right.
Blip wasn't around. Rever wasn't around.
YouTube wasn't around.
I mean, YouTube was kind of...
No, it wasn't even. It was the glimmer of things. And one of the things that's changed is, for years and years, the distribution factor has always been the big stumbling thing for somebody who's making either a movie or a short film or a radio show or whatever that happens to be. And unless you had a distribution deal with one of the major studios, you weren't going to have anyone see that outside of, say, some festivals or having a projector in your backyard and inviting your friends over to watch whatever thing you made.
Right.
And so now there are so many places to have your movie, show, radio, book, whatever, delivered to the world that distribution isn't the factor anymore. You know, I don't have to talk to Addison Wesley. I don't have to talk to Wiley to get a book deal. I can upload it to one of 7 different services and say, print book.
Well, the question there, though, I agree distribution has become a lot easier, but the question there, and this is kind of a question I would ask Paul and maybe Lucas, it's easy to get your stuff out there, but the question that always is on everyone's mind is, how do you make any money off of it? And Paul, I'd like to start with you. Talk to me a little bit about the Diary of the Dead thing. What does that look like for you? Is that a springboard into something new, or you know, what has that done for you?
Well, basically, it's a lot easier to get people to listen to us now. You know, we've kind of like, I guess, whenever I talk to, you know, some producers or anyone like that's working, you know, in the business, you know, and I, you know, I say, well, you know, we have this film on the Diary of the Dead DVD. They're like, oh, really? So, you know, it helps. I guess it's easier to get people to listen to us now.
And have you seen yourself get more work as a result of that?
Well, freelance work in a way, yeah. not directing work, but freelance work, because it shows, you know, what you can do, your abilities and things like that. But people haven't really, like, I haven't gotten any phone calls or, you know, people are like, oh yeah, we have this script and we want you to direct it. And I really didn't expect that, because I guess it's not really the way it works. Like, you kind of have to chase them in a way.
Right. You have to chase them and wave in front of them what you have. Yeah.
Right, exactly.
Well, I think that's true definitely of traditional Hollywood. I mean, I know Lucas, for example, worked on... I mean, Lucas, you were like second unit on a couple of films. You weren't even in the visual effects department. Is that right?
Yeah, I was working at a post-production company for a while, and it wasn't part of Troublemaker Studios, which is Robert Rodriguez's, you know, main studio. But we did a lot of the, you know, just I was the guy in the back room processing videotapes and, you know, just, you know, taking stuff that they were shooting and logging it and doing kind of like, you know, just that sort of stuff. So I really haven't, yeah, worked on anything too major, at least not in a major role by any stretch of the imagination. So.
Well, but with the advent of the work that you're doing now on Pigeon Impossible, if you look at that, I mean, I was talking with someone over at Soft Image the other day, and they praised you like you were the guy who knows how to use Soft Image. I mean, they pointed to Pigeon Impossible as like the poster child for what you would do in Soft Image.
Wow. Well, that's a... Yeah, I guess that's the first time I've heard that.
Say thank you.
Yes.
Say thank you, Soft Image.
Thank you, Soft Image. Could you put that in a press release, possibly?
But I've noticed, too, that the Pigeon Impossible, I mean, tell me a little bit about that. I mean, you've been working on it for 4 years. You put it out there. I mean, you kind of hung yourself out pretty hard with this show, and it just started taking off within the last few weeks, right? I mean, there's a lot of episodes out there, but, I mean, it looks like the curve is, as far as my peer group of people who have heard of it, it increased, you know, dramatically in the last few weeks.
Yeah, well, and that's actually kind of what I was hoping, as far as like my whole target audience for that, the podcast specifically, is other professionals in the industry. And it's gotten a lot of, you know, there's been a lot of students that have picked it up and all that, but it does seem like now it's finally starting to get into that target market that I was really shooting for, which is, yeah, just other pros doing the same sort of thing and all that sort of stuff. So it does make me really happy to, you know, to see the other guys are, you know, taking it that seriously, because this is the first animated thing that I've ever done. So, you know, it's a good thing that I didn't start doing the podcast 2 years ago, because it would have been like, how do I move this cube sort of stuff until now. So I don't think that it would have had the same response.
Yeah, and it's interesting, because I think Mark Christensen can really talk directly about this kind of framework, right? Is you put yourself out there as in a lot of ways an instructor. You put yourself out there as someone who was kind of showing other people how to do things. I mean, I noticed like episode, I think it's 2, 3, or 4. One of them is about lighting and all the problems that you had with lighting.
Mm-hmm.
And you're not kidding around. You walk through all the problems you had. I mean, you sort of like, say you set yourself up as an instructor. Mark, you've had a lot of experience with that. I mean, you've been an instructor for how long's the Great Tome of Christensen been out?
Let's see. The first one, I think, I lose track, actually. I think it's a little bit before your 2 year window there.
Yeah.
But not a lot before. And there have been a few editions, and I'm at work on another one. But what exactly is your question for me here?
Well, my question really relates to, how do you find being an instructor? How do you find that helps you as somebody in the, what I'm going to call the new media business, although I hate that phrase? You know, do you find that people see the Great Tome of Christensen and go, oh, wow, well, I'd love to have you do some work? Or do you find that it's other work that you're doing,
it definitely leads to work, and it definitely, it's definitely documents one's expertise in the field. And I think legitimately so, in that to do a good book, you have to be willing to get, or online or whatever. I mean, you have to be honest. You have to actually, like, good writing and good making of instructional videos is good thinking. And so you have to be able to think things through. And if there's something not connecting for you, you have to figure it out. And you have to share with other people what it was that you had to figure out. And while I agree to some extent that how do I move this box wouldn't be so interesting as some of the higher level stuff, I think it might be super interesting to a bunch of people who are stuck in the same place. And I mean, I also don't do much basic stuff. My book is really focused on a certain niche, which is kind of more, I mean, for what visual effects would be more basic level, but for what After Effects books are out there, it's quite a bit more advanced than most of the other offerings, or much more focused on a sort of second and third level of what you can do. I just saw an opportunity after working on some visual effects features to take this kind of whole realm from what was a dark art, visual effects companies, like software companies, were notorious for sharing none of their tricks. And the truth is that a huge percentage of the work is made up of building blocks that come up again and again and again. And they don't belong to anyone. I mean, there's nobody who owns the process of replacing a sky or comping an inferno, you know, into a burning building or whatever. I mean, there are a few different ways you can do it. There are one or two ways that are quite a bit better than others for specific reasons that can be explained, and nobody was explaining them. And so I took, you know, what is kind of the most popular software out there to do this, which helps legitimize doing a book where you say specific things about how to do it in this or that software.
Right.
And then, that's what I did.
Yeah, and it probably wouldn't be the Great Tome of Christensen if it were about flame, because no one has access to that. I mean, I don't know what I think the audience would be a lot smaller, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And they'd be like, what did you do? How dare you write about that?
Right.
That's possible, although I think that's changing. Effects PhD, which is a site I'm associated with and teach at, you know, I think what most people have found doing stuff there is the more you give away, the more you get back. Like, what has happened for me, in addition to just legitimizing my career, is that just really interesting other points, extra pieces of expertise in areas that I wasn't as strong on, whatever, have come out of the woodwork, and it's very collegial. It's actually doesn't feel like anybody's, you know, kind of trying to hide anything from anybody else. It's like there's an attitude of, you know, sharing stuff. So a lot of good stuff comes from offering stuff to the world that way.
One of the things that you get when you are a teacher is that you get expertise. you've done this again, you've shown this again and again and again, and you've heard every single question, like how do I make a keyframe, or how do I make an interpolating keyframe, you know, those things, or how do I make this ease in? And so over time, you've heard this enough stuff, things to say, here's this, here's this, here's this. And so you become even more of an expert.
Yeah, although that gets into an area, I have no patience for re-explaining things that are well documented in like the software documentation and so on. And I have a really hard time even writing stuff in my book that I want to recontextualize and just flesh out a little bit into the context of, say, visual effects. It's still really hard for me to write about it when it's like, you know, you could also just kind of read the manual. But truthfully, I just try to put myself back in the position of somebody who's doing it. But it's a reason that I don't do more of the base level training and teaching, is because I just personally, I find I get a little too bored with it. Is that kind of what your thought was as well, Lucas, with the,
Yeah. I was actually just going to add that I think that that's the, when I started PI, that was the thing that I was missing most was, I mean, there were tons of books out there that talk about the nuts and bolts, or, you know, like, here's how you use this tool and here's how you use this tool. But when it came to actual techniques, like, you know, how do you build a rig that's going to give you what the animator needs to do his thing, all that sort of stuff. Like, there was nothing at that high level, at least when I was starting to do all this. It seems like there's more of that stuff now. But I know one other thing that I'd add, just because we were talking about the whole teaching side of things, is that I know I find that I learn stuff even better when I'm having to present it to someone else. So in other words, like, one of the other side products that I've gotten out of doing this podcast is that I, you know, all the techniques that I've kind of internalized and all that, it helps me so much by revisiting them and having to present them to somebody. It just sort of like, you know, kind of like does a little like mental reset and clears the library of your brain a little bit so that you have a much more cohesive knowledge of it. I don't know if anyone else, like Mark, if you found something like that where you,
definitely.
By doing that sort of stuff.
Absolutely. I mean, there are literally times, like with effects PhD, there are times where I start recording a class, get into it, and realize, you know what, actually, I got to research this a little more because I'm not prepared to give the full A to Z on this yet.
It makes because it is a performance, and sometimes you have to practice your performance a few times before you're ready to go.
Yeah, I mean, and it's okay to admit, oh gosh, I have no idea what I'm doing. I mean, that's what I was saying about doing your base level stuff. I mean, in a way, a smart person encountering something for the first time and what doesn't make sense about it, I'm sure there are thousands of people who would be right there with you. And it takes a certain amount of courage to do that. But I was just, before I came down here, was recording a class involving incorporating red footage, taking it from Final Cut into After Effects. Well, that's not a straightforward process. And I had to do a little bit of a reality check. I'm like, okay, I think what I'm doing is the best way to do this, but I like to be a little bit confident that I'm not forgetting something really obvious. Or, you know.
Yeah. Yeah,
well,
exactly.
A tough thing is too, that as you, when you're talking about something so like upper level like that, you start getting into all these other things. Like, do you take, you know, 15 minutes to talk about, you know, gamma curves and all these other kind of esoteric things? It's like, where do you draw the line?
Right. Or bit depth for the color space. Or, I mean, there's just so many things that kind of are baggage that come with the problem of just the simple act of moving footage from Final Cut to After Effects.
The very cool thing, though, about having it be a podcast or new media, I'm using air quotes, is that you can just reference that and say, here's this thing on gamma curves. Go listen to this if you don't understand.
Exactly.
And it's, you know, it becomes the hyperlink to a better explanation so that you don't have to spend 15 minutes in your primary explanation about what that might be.
Yeah, I had a really interesting moment last night on Twitter where I was asking about there's Nuke training from SphereFX or SphereVFX that just came out. And I was asking if this was the comprehensive Nuke training. Well, it turned out a bunch of people responded to me in this new media context and said, oh yeah, that looks like this. And it turns out that the FX PhD class on Nuke, you know, Nuke 102, along with just the work that was done on the Foundry site that's available for free, is as comprehensive as, you know, this DVD that I was going to order. Now, it's not all collected in one place, and it's not simply delivered to me, and I can't watch it on a TV easily and all that. But, you know, just the idea that that media is out there. So it's exactly what you're talking about, John Foster, this referential sort of pointing over there and going, oh, yeah, it's this collective. what I referred to on one of the previous TWIMs as this, you know, two-way conversation.
Well, it's like referencing, it's like being able to point to Stu's book and say, get Stu's book. Right.
And then come back and talk to me after you've read it, because I don't, there's 300 pages of stuff I don't want to have to walk you through.
Right. One of the things that I noticed when I was teaching all the time, when I had students who had never been exposed to editing or special effects or any of that, it took about 8 weeks into the class before they had the vocabulary in order to be able to have a conversation with me. It was like you were talking to somebody in Spanish, and they didn't know enough words in order to ask the questions.
Right, exactly.
And so eventually what happened is you've gone rah, 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 enough to the point where they're like, oh, hey. Rah, 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 rah.
Well, and I could see that sort of stuff too, especially happening with, you know, whether you're talking about movies or new media or whatever, where just that it encompasses so many different disciplines, you know, from music, editing, storytelling, you know, photography, all these different things go together, that you really do have to have at least a base understanding in all the other things to even have a conversation about it.
Absolutely. Hey, I wanted to ask you guys, you know, in the spirit of, we sort of started this with, you know, how's media changed and what, a little bit about what you guys have done. What do you think, what outlets are people using today? I know that in Paul's case, Paul, you have something on Chiller TV that I've been voting on. I'm not, is that Fallout? Right.
It's a short film that we recently shot. It's called Fallout. And, you know, it's a 6-minute film, and it's in the Chiller TV contest. So if you go to the Chiller TV Dare to, Chiller TV Dare to Direct contest.
Yeah.
So if you go to their website, you can check it out on there.
Are you finding are others finding that you know, YouTube, Vimeo, Blip TV? I mean, are any of these outlets? Are you guys using any of these outlets to really drive traffic, or is there some other thing that you're saying is like maybe the better choice? I mean, I guess I'm just trying to wonder what. I'm wondering and asking the question: what outlets are important today?
I think that you know, YouTube is a good outlet, but it's become really, I guess, oversaturated. So, you know, if you put something up on Vimeo, you might actually get noticed. Whereas if you put something up on YouTube, there's so much stuff on YouTube that it might be hard for, you know, someone to get noticed through, you know, YouTube.
And do you find the quality matters? Because I know for me, like personally, I literally can't watch something on YouTube unless I'm on a small screen and 10 feet away, because it just makes me nauseous.
Yeah, that's why I've kind of like moved a lot of my videos over to Vimeo's, because, you know, the quality is so much better. And like, you know, when some people can't tell, it actually kind of destroys your production value in a way, because, you know, if your raw footage looks great, and then, you know, you do your color grading and all that stuff, and it looks even better, and then you have to compress it where it's all blocky and stuff, and, you know, then it kind of, I think it decreases the production value of your work.
Yeah, I've found that so that media show is really an interesting thing for me, because right now, despite being on the front page of Blip and things like that, 90% of the people who view it actually view it through iTunes. And I'm happy about that, because they're viewing a version that I compressed that has kind of the look and feel that I want, instead of the, you know, tread upon, stomped upon, regurgitated look that Vimeo, Blip, and YouTube seem to have.
You know, this is the funniest thing, because I've heard, oh, it's compressed out. Oh, it doesn't look as good as my uncompressed on my big screen. I've heard this for almost 15 years.
Yes.
You know, because we've gone through
Cinepak. Well, it must be true then. Everyone's saying it.
Well, but what I'm saying is, it's gone through Cinepak. It's gone through Sorensen. It's gone through, you know, MPEG-4. It's gone through all these different things. It's like, guys, embrace the fact that it's going to look like that and figure out how to make it look as good as possible in that medium. I mean, this is what I've had to do with 2X CD-ROMs. This is what I had to do with Real Media when they came out with their video. I mean, this has been the hugest problem to solve. And so instead of whining about it, going, oh, it looks so compressed, oh, I don't want to watch it, like, that's where your viewers are. And so just go, hey, I got to let's do 95 iterations of this to find out what one looks good. And then maybe even share it with the class when you're all done, or keep it as your thing. But, you know, there's a lot of video out there that looks awesome on YouTube.
Another possibility too is just sort of embracing the crappiness. You know, like yeah. I know that's one thing, like with the PI podcast, I've tried really hard to, you know, to keep it, you know, like I shoot the whole thing on a webcam, and you know, I some people might not like that so much, but I know personally I feel like it makes it a little bit more sort of, you know, it takes some of the, you know, some of the production value away, but in a way that makes it feel more like this is just a dude sitting in front of his computer talking about this stuff, and it makes it more personal away. And I really don't care so much about the picture quality of stuff that I'm finding. I care more about the content.
Yeah, that reminds me of Zay Frank's The Show. I mean, he shot that on his webcam, and you know, it looked pretty good actually, given that it was shot on a webcam. But it was definitely, you know, there was no air of trying to create high quality video.
Well,
it was just crappy.
But he embraced that
totally,
and
it made the show.
And
yeah,
really, it made it seem like, hey, he's just doing. He's not thinking about this. He's just doing it.
Right.
Although the blinking part always got to me.
Yeah.
The non-blinking part.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, it was kind of funny because when we put up our Diary of the Dead entry on MySpace, we got a lot of comments. Like, some people were like, oh, well, you know, if I had a good camera and if I had a mansion to run into and whatever, you know, then I'm sure, you know, they would have picked my film. And I was like, I shot on the DVX. There are some people that shot on HD. And, you know, and it's funny because, like, even like sites like YouTube, they say MPEG-4 is the best format to put it up on there. It retains the highest quality, whatever. But I actually uploaded everything on Windows Media Video or WMV format.
Right.
And that actually I found gave me the best results. And you know, I mean, we got a lot of comments where people were like, oh, you know, what kind of camera did you use? Or you know, some people were complaining about, you know, like, oh, well, you know, they must have had a budget or, you know, they have a really awesome camera. And it's not like we shot on like a Varicam or a Red camera. You know, I would say about at least 50% of the videos that were in the contest were shot on the DVX or something around that price range or better. So it really is just like learning, you know, what works best and also knowing your equipment and knowing how to get the best picture out of it.
And lighting.
And yeah.
And sound.
Yeah.
And writing. Don't forget writing. And make sure she's hot. If she's right. Even if she's going to get decapitated, still, she's got to be hot.
Well, I mean, you know.
And there better be good bagels on the set, too. Not just those ones from Safeway, but.
All you need is good crafty, and you've got a stellar movie. Nothing
better. Well, yeah. It
crafts,
really
lighting, and sound. I think those are the keys.
Wow.
And a star.
Yeah. And attitude, lots of attitude, and a trailer. Trailers, sorry, I want one.
Wow, so that's,
I'm making fun of the whole thing, just so everybody knows. Sarcasm tags are big.
That just, you know, speaking of just making fun of it and all that, the, you know, one of the things that John, you and I have talked about, and one of the things I've, you know, talked about a little bit on previous episodes is how we measure success. So there's a really interesting, like, I would say Paul is way successful.
Sure.
Diary of the Dead. I mean, the stuff he's doing, the Chiller TV, Fallout on Chiller TV is really good. I mean, successful.
Well, he's on the show, so obviously success.
I think Pigeon Impossible is amazing. You know, I think everyone here at this table, I mean, is, you know, has some success. But the question really is, how do you measure it? Because I don't know the numbers on Pigeon Impossible, but I do know the numbers on like That Media Show and on This Week in Media and things like that. And I think that we have a group of people, rebels, if you will, who really don't look at the numbers.
I don't.
In the same way that other people do. Like, if I have 500 quality listeners on Life Zero, I'm happy because there are 500 people who are giving, you know, feedback and quality and things like that.
Right, right. The biggest problem with the numbers is that they are numbers. They can be anything that you want them to be. They can be, you know, if they're not if they're not big numbers, they're little numbers, and so those could be disappointing numbers. And if they're big numbers, that means you have a bigger problem because you're paying for more bandwidth, you have higher expectations, you have, you know, you've got this runaway success that you might not be able to pay for or may not be able to follow up on. Okay, so I'm using that as the extreme. Like, okay, I'm just this guy with a camera and I get successful and I have a $30,000 bandwidth bill. Because I'm on a crap server that I didn't read my terms of service.
Yeah, I actually moved my show from Podbean to Blip because of the cost of bandwidth. Because the cost of bandwidth was just way overwhelming.
Yeah. So there is that. And so, you know, a lot of times, one of the ways that I measure success when I'm looking at these things is what's my feedback? How much traffic am I getting back from people saying, hey, you suck? Because if a lot of people are saying you suck, well, they bothered to listen to it. They were compelled enough to write in and say that, and something about that pissed them off. So I'm going to take away something from this and go, wow, maybe I do suck. Maybe there is something to change here. Maybe there's something to learn from this. And what happens is over time, those people stop listening anyway, but then you've improved upon what you've done.
Right.
The other way to measure, to the way that I look at measuring success is, am I still doing it? You know, the saying is, you're only as good as your last job.
Right.
And so I'm still working. I'm still doing this. I'm still, you know, making, I'm still doing things for people because they say, oh, wow, I really liked that thing that you did 4 years ago or 6 months ago, whatever that is. And so that's a good way to measure success. The other one to think about is, don't even try to measure it. Just do the things that are making you happy. You know, a lot of guys get hung up in this. Every single podcaster at every single event asks, how do I make money at this?
Right.
Right. As if that's the measure of success. Right. Well, maybe you need to reset the way that you're thinking about that and say, I know how to do a show. I know how to research a show, or I've been invited to do other things, or I'm talking at this event, or, you know, whatever those single event things are.
Well, I alluded to that earlier when I asked if there was something about making money, or if you guys saw it as a springboard. I mean, I look at the work that Mark is doing with FXPhD, and I have to ask, you know, is this about how many people are watching it, or is this about putting yourself out there and kind of developing a core audience and letting people know that you have some After Effects skill and that, you know, you're willing to share it and things like that? I mean, it seems like you're developing a fan base, Mark.
Well, actually, I would like to speak to this a little bit, because I think there's something right in the middle of everything we've been talking about here that it has to do with, you know, it. I mean, basically, what you're always looking for is enthusiasm. Just other people's enthusiasm for what you've offered to the world, what you've given and what you've sparked in other people is kind of what this all comes back to, whether you're doing your own creative movie or whether you're doing some teaching, writing a book, whatever. And so the opposite of enthusiasm is just people ignoring it. And so we've moved definitely into a world where, on the one hand, it's really true. You can say, this is my thing, and get it right out there. Like, you don't have to anymore say, this is my thing, and wait for somebody else to give you permission for that to be your thing. It's really true, everything that's been said about that. But that doesn't mean that you won't still be toiling away in a certain amount of obscurity until you basically, you know, hit on some level of other people's enthusiasm, which is probably starts with your own, I'm guessing. Like, it starts with your own understanding of, you know, like, this is something I really want to do.
Yeah, I'm curious. You know, one of the things that I think gets overlooked a lot is just the sheer volume of work required to write a book like After Effects Studio Technique, or to do a 4-year process like Pigeon Impossible.
So that's what I wanted to speak to directly, because I actually, before I joined up with FXPhD in particular, I was looking at developing my own, you know, sort of set of training. And I was puzzling over, well, I know if I just put it on a blog and started to give it away, I'd get crazy amounts of traffic, you know, but I'd have no model to recoup on it. And I do things at a kind of high standard, so it takes me quite a bit of time to do it, and I'm obligated, you know, for a certain amount of income. So it was really hard to crack that nut. And on the other side of the scale, self-producing a project for a DVD, you know, previously, before, and 2 years ago is, again, a decent mark of this. Before about that pivot point, there were instructional DVDs selling for several hundred dollars and, you know, not necessarily very good, but often the only thing available out there. And as that barrier to entry kind of came down and it became more possible to just put out and distribute a DVD without right. actually having to have a thousand of them sitting in your garage and you're the guy who has to stick them in an envelope and send them, because that's around the time that all changed too. It became really tempting to self-produce, but I actually find that I do a lot better with a much more direct connection to kind of other people, both while I'm working on it and in terms of getting feedback on it as I'm doing it. That seems to be something of a common thread here as well.
Absolutely. Yeah, that feedback loop where the audience helps you get better and helps guide, you know, the direction by just improving the direction.
Well, it reminds me that it makes a difference what you're doing. And it keeps, in my case, it keeps me from being a little too perfectionistic, which personally is, you know, that's something that I fall into, where I'll keep working on something when really a deadline and just getting it out would make it nearly as good.
Dude, I'm in post-production for 16 months on a film that I'm on the fourth edit of. You know, I mean, you can, yeah, believe me, I understand the idea of perfection. It's ridiculous.
C-I-L, my editor. Times four. Okay, you don't get the reference.
About every third thing you say, I just kind of stare off into the distance with an odd smile on my face. I'm like, what?
There's some guy out there going, that's really funny. So I wrote that for you, dude.
So the one guy. So Paul, are you finding there's a way to get your stuff out there that's not Diary of the Dead, not Chiller TV, or are you? I mean, because there's stuff out there like, I'm really excited, as you guys know, about this idea of getting your film and your short films onto iTunes or into something where there's some revenue potential. So there's stuff like BritShorts.com, which allows you to put stuff on iTunes, short films, and they have a bizarre process that you have to go through. And then there's MeDeploy, which is a fairly recent development. Any familiarity with MeDeploy?
No. I don't even know what that is.
I don't think it goes through iTunes. I think it's its own kind of one-off thing where people pay for it or whatever. I mean, there's I'm trying to remember the name. There's something called Around the Bend with Ewan McGregor, the motorcycle. Do you guys know what I'm talking about? Mm-hmm. He sold it for, you know, like $1.99 or $2.99 an episode, and there were several episodes, and it did really well online. But I think that's an exception. I think the rule is, when you look at stuff like Gemini Division and things like that, I think the rule is that the real money that a lot of people are making tends to be, frankly, in iTunes or in an iTunes-like interface. Because the less extra crap I have to set up to just hit that one-click buy button, you know, so if it's Amazon or if it's iTunes, it seems like there's a much higher probability there. I guess my question is, are you guys seeing conduits for independent filmmakers these days? Because that was the biggest complaint when TWIM first started, is there was no way as an independent filmmaker to get your stuff out there for a fee.
Well, one of the there's two really cool things that exist if you want to do a more traditional box, and that is, one of them is called Amazon Create Space. And the other one is Lulu, where basically you pay them to make a one-off DVD. It's $7.50 per, and you can put that on your website, do all the self-promotion you want. You can set your sell price for whatever you want it to be. So you're actually going to make, you know, if you sold it for $20, you're going to make $12.50. And
do they have relationships with Amazon?
Yes.
And
Amazon,
Netflix and all that stuff?
Amazon Create Space actually puts that movie into Amazon, into the Amazon store. So if you search for My Great Movie or Zombie Strippers 4 on Amazon, then you would find that would show up. Actually, there is no Zombie Strippers 4.
But right. There's only one. Yeah. I was at the premiere in Vegas. Did you Are you finding that there are success stories out of this, or is this just another
it's
one
so
of those
obscure.
Sort of,
no
you
one,
know?
No one knows about this because these guys don't go and promote this to the filmmaking community. I mean, like, this has been a subject that has come up repeatedly since it got made 2 years ago on the show. And, you know, Alex just goes, well, I'm not – DVDs are dead to me. Like, no, Zimbabwe, Al Jazeera, DVDs are dead. Oops.
And so are we finding that DVDs are a kind of a – I mean, there's a certain mentality that people have, which is like, I've never heard of Lulu. I've never heard of Me Deploy. Right. I've never heard of these things.
But see,
do you think there's a stigma associated with this?
You don't have – I mean, as the – like, okay, we didn't hear about YouTube. We didn't know about Vimeo. We didn't know about those other tools, you know, a year and a half ago.
Yeah, this story's been told over and over again. I mean, the internet itself was a fringe medium at one point.
Yeah,
and you know, it was like full of wackos making websites, and then all of a sudden, you know, 2 years later.
But who cares if the person, our end user knows about this? We don't care. Because really, as the media maker, it's to me to do my self-promotion to drive traffic to make that go. It's not just going to automatically happen.
Well, that's right. So what if it was 1993 and the question was, well, is it really becoming possible for everyone to do a website who wants to do one? I mean,
yeah,
you know, think about
that's actually not the question I'm asking. The question I was asking was, is there a stigma associated with some of these sites? Because Vimeo and all those things are great, but you can't really make money off of them, right?
Well,
I'm talking about like in the old media versus what I'm going to call media new from now on. Is there a stigma associated with a Lulu or another distribution method or a self distribution method? Because I know
I think the point I'm making
a lot of people frown on that.
I just want to make this point really quick. Whether there's a stigma or not, that probably will change over time. The overarching trend seems to be that it's getting easier and easier to get your stuff out where people can see it, and it will continue to do so. If past trends hold true, the struggle or the challenge will be to actually get people to see it.
Right, exactly. And that's a big concern. That's why I asked, is there an example of someone who's actually had some success out of this?
Yeah, I think, Lucas, were you going to ring in on this?
Oh, well, I was just going to add something kind of along the lines of the Lulu and the stigma thing, whereas now there might be a stigma for other distributors, but as far as like the end user, the person who's actually going to buy it, they're still, you know, in Lulu's case, you're still getting a printed book or a printed DVD. It's still, you know, it's not like it's, you know, some weird thing that they had to go down to the corner store and buy out of a, you know, buy from the guy with the crazy overcoat or something. You know, it's still just coming over the internet, which is how so many people get stuff anyways. So
you guys you don't worry about this, right? This thing about it feeling fringy or.
It's on Amazon.
Yeah,
I mean, it's on my website.
Right, and nobody looks. I mean, the very few people in the general populace look to see if something is from Fox Searchlight or I mean, most people don't even think about those kind of things.
I mean, A-list directors would definitely care.
Right,
about
A-list
that.
Would direct
people already
would,
in the Hollywood system.
I'm saying
would care a lot
the general public.
Stuff.
The general public isn't going to look at
the unpublished,
yeah,
as it were, director or producer of media. Probably wouldn't look past that.
I'm curious. We should try and experiment, guys. We should try and figure out a way to get a film out there. And I theoretically have a film coming out at some point, but we should try and figure out how to get a film out there where we self-distribute it and we take out, you know, some billboard ads and some television spots and just see, you know, in one market, right? Like San Francisco or LA, and just see what the reaction is. See if the reaction is the same if you're doing self-distribution.
I would even go one more. I wouldn't even bother with billboards and advertising. I would just advertise on the Twitter.
And I see what the word of mouth
and see
looks
what
like.
The word of, see what the buzz will create. You know, there's that Octopus film is a good example. Octopati, I don't know if you guys have seen that, but...
I mentioned it on this show and on that media show.
Okay, so it was, it was something that I saw about a month and a half ago.
Yeah.
And I posted it on the pixelcore.com forum. And, here was the high-res version, here was this, and... A month, and it took basically from that point when I had found it to seeing it on the front page of Dig or Reddit or one of those.
Yeah.
It was about a month and a half for that to gain traction. And of course, it's already gone.
I keep beating this to death here, but I mean, I guess my question is, okay, so Octopati got a lot of buzz, but then, you know, what, I mean, since we're talking about trying to make it, and as Mark rightfully pointed out, we do have, you know, a brother's got to eat.
Right.
Right. Well, so how do we turn this into something that's tangible and sustainable is really the bigger question.
The question also comes up, do you really have to make money off of the thing itself? Because I know I'm not really planning on, I mean, I put 4 years into this project. If you add up the number of hours that I've put in, it's impossible for me to make back just any sort of, you know, more than like, you know, 12 cents an hour, sort of like sweatshop rates. So for me, I'm thinking that, you know, I'm hoping that the payback will come in the terms of doing larger projects, and, you know, that will be the thing. So for me, I'm not really too worried about making money on this. I want to cover my costs. So, you know, hopefully a little bit of stuff here and there, just so I don't go into the hole over it. But I'm not really too concerned about making money on, you know, at least on this project. And I think that holds true for other people. But are you talking more about something like this where it's a one-time sort of thing? Or are you talking more about like, you know, kind of a syndicated show sort of model?
Well, I guess I was speaking in a kind of a generality. I have a question for you. What were you doing on the side while you were doing Pigeon Impossible? Because 4 years, you had to do something, right?
Oh, yeah. I was working at a post house. I think I mentioned that before. I've been freelance for the last year and a half about. So, you know, I take gigs. I do some commercials. I work on, you know, features and effects and all sorts of stuff. And I mean, it's all, and that's the thing, because the stuff that I'm doing for the podcast and for the movie, it's all directly related to my field. So the two are kind of intertwined, and it's almost kind of a huge publicity thing more than a money thing.
Right. And so PI has actually had it's an opportunity for you to do other work, and it's also something to point to, right? It's something online that you can say, I did that.
If you
want to know what I'm capable of, this is basically my demo reel.
Yeah, exactly.
That's pretty interesting. Is everyone else finding that as well? I know that for me, that media show has been a really interesting springboard, because if someone says, you know, what have you done lately? I just sort of point. Say, well, I'm doing this, you know, on no budget, with no staff, with no, you know.
Well, my thing is that not a lot of people know this, but MacBreak Tech was a show that I used as a, I don't know, proving ground, a playground, breadboard. That's the best way to describe it. And since July, I've been working on a whole new series of things that won't be MacBreak anything. They'll be their own thing, and that is built with the. With the idea of embracing Amazon, their affiliate program, of embracing getting paid for talking about products that we believe in,
right?
You know, and you know, selling all the other junk that goes with it, you know, like shirts and books and printables, that kind of thing.
I'm just curious. I know that we have kind of a weird cross section here, and we have some people in what you know you might consider visual effects and post production, and then we have a couple of filmmakers, and then
there's me,
then there's pre production, and so I would say, Foster, you're more on the camera side.
Yeah,
I'm probably more on the filmmaker side.
Yeah.
Paul seems like he's more on the director side, you know, and then Mark and Lucas seem like they're much more on the visual effects side. So we've got kind of a nice cross section.
But
here.
I didn't want to be on the camera side. I mean, it just ended.
John, you're on the camera side.
I know, but I just ended. Well, and the thing was is that if you really want to control your destiny, you have to be on both sides. You have to be on the camera side. You have to be on the microphone
right.
side. You have to be the writer, the producer, the director. I mean, you have to own it. And that's what I've really found is that if I go and if I want to get a sponsor, if I want to get work from a client, guess what I'm doing? I'm their hands, you know, and they may be idiots because clients don't really know how to convey the creative things that they want. And they keep asking for changes and changes and changes. And eventually you get something that can kind of resemble what they think. But you know, it's a very frustrating way to have your day go. And, you know, when it's your show, when you are calling the shots, you know, it's your outline, it's your writing. In fact, you know, I'm halfway responsible for this thing that we're listening to.
Sure. We're both to blame.
Yeah. And so, you know, I'm actually really happy about what we did. And, but, you know, it's that ownership that's there. And from, you know, like one of the very frustrating things for me in listening to the show for basically 20 episodes is that it's this Hollywood love fest. And the thing is I'm not in that. I don't do that. I don't chase that. And yet I'm making, I've got 60 episodes of things about beer. Sure. Audio about beer. I've got a whole bunch of tech shows that talk about Mac stuff. And so, in a way I'm living the dream. Not sure. In a way. I am living the dream because
sure.
This is my content and I can tell a sponsor, no, I don't want you. I can choose to whether or not I make money. I get to write that stuff that's there. And, if I want to make cartoons as a side project, I can do that. I don't have to answer to anybody to say, oh yeah, can't do that because it's not my day job.
Yeah, it's sort of one of the places I was going with all of this is if I look at the people who inspire me, they are the rebels, right? I mean, obviously the notion that a filmmaker has to be familiar with the front end and the back end and visual effects and all that is something that I think Robert Rodriguez has certainly seared into all of our brains. But for me, I'm a big fan of David Fincher, who's actually kind of popular now, but wasn't when I got started. But I'm also a fan of, Jim Jarmusch, Hal Hartley, I mean, Woody Allen. I mean, these are guys who make movies for $500,000 to $2 million and
they make 10 million.
And they make 10 million, and then they go to DVD and make a little bit more. And so,
right. Well, I make content that costs $100 and it makes 500.
Exactly. And so that's exactly the direction that I'm going in is the media new world more about making the content that you believe in for for a reasonable rate, it's sort of an outside the unions, outside Hollywood, well, outside all these
we
things.
We talked a little bit about this and we were talking about why does it have to look like a show? Why does it have to be, the news? Or why does it have to be episodic TV? This notion that it has to be 22 minutes long or 48 minutes long or, have a stinger and a intro and an outro and a ta-da.
I mean, Paul Del Vecchio, what do you see? Like, what would be your ideal?
Well, I mean, the whole goal of, ever since I started making films with my buddy Dave, we decided last December that, we just wanted to, crank out as much as we could. And the whole goal wasn't to make money. It was actually to get better at our craft. I mean, there are a lot of people that, they make one feature film and then, they might get lucky and they might, start making more. But the thing is that, the more you do it, the better you get. So I'm not going to wait until one of my films, I get big off one of my films or something like that because, who knows if that'll ever happen. But the whole goal was just to get better at what we do. And, and thus far, I mean, we have a pretty cool reel now, between the Got Milk commercial that we shot, the Netflix spec commercial, and now the the Diary of the Dead, and now Fallout. The whole thing was, basically it was just an agreement between me and Dave that we would just consistently work so that we can get better at what we do, and then eventually, hopefully, one day we can get someone's attention. But we didn't want to, jump into the whole Hollywood system or jump into the whole making films and doing feature films and stuff when we weren't prepared. We wanted to have experience before we got to a certain point. So that was basically the idea behind it. It's just to get better at what we do because we want to be good at what we do when we get to a certain point. Otherwise, people will start calling you out on it, and that's not a good thing because you won't be prepared and you won't know what to do.
Oh, people will call you out anyway, Paul.
Well, that's true.
That's but, nice. I mean,
well, so Paul, it sounds like you're going to find a way to keep doing it without having to make any of these other models work. They're just, I'm not going to say they're gravy because clearly you're shooting to actually make this be, more and more your sole profession and get more and more choices about what you do. But it sounds like you're going to, to a certain extent, do that anyway. Do you think that's true?
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to go into my next, if I make a feature film next, I don't want to go into it and be like, yeah, this is the thing that's going to, start my career and stuff. I just want to keep on making films and get better at what I do. And, eventually, hopefully someone will, you know, notice and they'll be like, you know, we'll get someone's attention. I mean, it's not just about making money. We care about making good content, because I don't want to be someone who, you know, makes it to Hollywood just by luck and then, you know, I put out like crap films for the rest of my career. You know, I actually want to have like a decent career and you know, like, you know, if I ever make it there, you know, I want to be creating good content, because it's hard to find good content. And I think that's really like what you're, that's how you're going to make the most money, is if you make good content. Like, you know, you can advertise all you want, but you know, when opening weekend, when a film comes out and it sucks, no one's going to care. Like the next weekend, it's going to drop more than 50% in sales because no one cares. And they heard that, you know, the movie sucks or whatever. So, basically, yeah, you know, like I said, our goal was just to get better at what we do and, you know, get experience, and then eventually, hopefully someone notices.
It's interesting that, you know, one of the questions that we get asked the most on this show and on other shows that we're on is, how do you give yourself permission? I mean, they don't ask it in that way. People say, how do you know, basically they say, how do you talk yourself into it? How do you, how do you take that next step?
What degree should I get?
Yeah. Or how can I mean, the biggest question I get is, how can I do what you do? Like what steps do I need to take to get there? And Paul, it sounds like in your case, I don't know if you went to film school or anything like that. I know that many of us didn't. But in your case, it seems like you just gave yourself permission and just did it.
Well, yeah. Like my story is kind of like, I guess, similar to a lot of other people's, because like I was shooting, you know, I've loved movies like my whole life. I was shooting on my dad's video camera when I was younger. And then, you know, I got into like special makeup effects when I was in college. And then, you know, from there I got back into directing because I read Rebel Without a Crew. So that kind of got me, it kind of woke me up, because like a lot of people were saying, you know, especially film students, they were saying like, oh, well, you know, you can't, you know, you can't make a movie by yourself, blah, blah, blah. It's so difficult. You need tons of money. I actually told a film student once that I was going to make a feature film. And, you know, he was like, well, how are you going to shoot it? You know, who's going to be your crew? And I said, I'll just, you know, pull a Robert Rodriguez and do everything myself. And he was like, no one can do that but Robert Rodriguez. And then, so like, yeah. And then a few months later, when I had my feature film when I had my feature film finished, I saw him at some convention or something like that. And I was like, what are you working on next? And he turned and he snapped at me and he was like, I'm working on a feature. You know, because I guess, you know, he heard that my feature was finished and stuff and whatever. But it's just like a lot of people will just, you know, are so negative when it comes to making a film. And, you know, reading Robert Rodriguez's book just kind of woke me up. And I was like, well, I can do this. You know, it kind of opened my eyes. And I was like, let me save up for a camera and then I'll go out and shoot. But in the meantime, I borrowed my friend's camera. I made a really bad 20-minute short film. And then the next thing, the next project, you know, I got the DVX and I just started making more films. And it's really just about going out and doing it. I mean, what, you know, it's not really, you kind of psychologically like scare yourself, you know, like, oh, it's too difficult. It's really, really, really hard to do it. I can't do this by myself. And it's all just psychological. I think that once you jump in and start doing it, it becomes, it's not easy, but it's easier than you think. And in some ways it is harder, but I would say like it was nowhere near as scary as I made it out to be.
I would disagree entirely.
Excellent.
Yeah. I mean, I have, I guess I kind of came at it the other way, because I really thought that when I was working on it, that I thought that, okay, well, let's see, it'll take about 4 or 5 months to figure it all out and, you know, how to do everything. Yeah, 4 years later, I'm still not done yet. So I don't know. I think the only reason that I was able to do stuff, I mean, there wasn't any sort of, you know, giving yourself permission. It was more, I just didn't know that I was supposed to get permission, and I didn't realize how hard it was going to be to do it. But some people are just that sort of person that once they're, you know, the more kind of obstacles that come into them, the more they just sort of like hunker down and they just, you know, kind of like shut everything out and, you know, just dig in and do whatever it takes to get it done. And even though that might have, you know, detriments to, you know, your personal life, your health, and, you know, probably every, you know, sane thing that you should be focusing on, you know, you eventually, hopefully the film will be done. And then, you know, you can, you know, go to Costa Rica for 6 months and recoup. So,
I have to agree. I mean, I think we're all inspired by, you know, Rebel Without a Crew. And I think it's a phenomenally good book. But the one thing that I think that it really misses as a book is just how hard it is. I mean, he washes over enormous parts of the process, and he's like, oh yeah, we managed to secure an actress and a hotel, and then next day we were shooting. You know, there's just enormous, like, vast wastelands of difficulty finding locations and things like that that are just sort of glossed over. But it is inspirational in a lot of ways.
But some of that's getting lucky.
Well, it's also interesting you say that, John, because you're such a Kubrick and, you know, Ridley Scott lover. And, you know, that's almost the opposite school of filmmaking from Robert Rodriguez. You know, I worked on a couple features for Robert, and honestly, you know, his feedback for visual effects is mostly enthusiasm. Like, he mostly just wants more. I mean, granted, I was working on things like Spy Kids 3D, but he mostly wants, oh yeah, more of that. And, you know, he just grooves on stuff. And there are things that I think other directors would just nitpick to death. And he, you know, in Rebel Without a Crew, he just says, you know, I mean, it goes back to the YouTube argument too. It's like, if people are paying attention to that, you've lost him. Like, if you can't create enough energy in this thing that you've got people looking at how grainy it is.
Ooh, or pixels.
Yeah, stuff like that, then, you know, in his book, you've lost him. If you're in the Ridley Scott, Stanley Kubrick camp, it's like, are you kidding me? I'm going to do my feature film for YouTube? You know, like, that's...
Well, I think you can have both, right? I mean, you can admire Kubrick for what he's been able to accomplish, and then you can admire Robert Rodriguez for his sort of can-do attitude.
Well, yeah, but I think at any given point, you're either going to say, it doesn't matter, it's good enough, or you're going to say, no, it has to be the way that I say that it is. And, you know, honestly, Robert Rodriguez is like that. He's just like that about very specific things and not about others.
Well, I find him inspirational partially because in my Kubrick-like way, I'm still editing a damn film for almost 2 years. I think the whole thing is really, it's really intriguing because Paul, it sounds like it inspired you to go out there. And, you know, Lucas, it sounds like from your perspective, there's a lot more work than people think there is. And I don't want to scare people, but I think there's a hell of a lot more work than people think there is shooting a film.
One of the things that I produced, wrote, and directed was a series of cartoons for an internet startup, and they were all around business, so very Dilbert-like kind of things. And so we borrowed heavily from that, lots of cliches and that.
Were they drawings or were they moving?
No, it was done in Flash.
Okay,
so Flash cartoons. And so the thing was is that we used non-talent for the voices. I was part of one of the voices on it. But the thing was, we had 8 weeks to finish all of them. They had, you know, it was like a hard out. Here it is. And of course, I'm like, okay. And the pipeline was basically me writing and then in the morning and then spending the rest of the day helping all the other people tweak stuff. And then we'd record in the evening because that was when the office was quiet. Huh. And we just did it on an SM58, plugged into a Mac, and did it. Thing was, is the, you know, in the beginning, you're like, yeah, 18 cartoons, sure, 8 weeks, no problem.
Right.
And, you know, halfway through, we changed our workflow a little bit to make things go and, like, discover Toon Boom and the awesome that it is. And you know, suddenly we're not animating the mouth with flaps. We're, you know, just editing it, you know, it goes, here's the points and the soundtrack. Yeah. The thing happens automatically. And, you know, who knew? But it was a lot of work. And at the end, like, we have this body of work that we're really proud of. And you know, looking back, it was a really, really fun project. And I didn't hate any of the process of doing that.
Well, and that brings up, too, just the whole format question. Whereas, you know, I mean, and I don't mean, you know, what are you shooting on? I mean more just sort of like, are you going for something that is super, super high level? Or are you going for something that is more, and I don't mean that it's a lesser quality, just more stylized is maybe a better way to put it.
Sure. Whereas, well, the cartoons, you know, yeah, were really stylized. I mean, it was the process really dictated what we got at the end.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think that's the big thing where a lot of times, like I know in my case, I sat down thinking, okay, I want to make something that is, you know, absolute studio quality. And I don't think a lot of people realize what goes into that. Now, as far as, you know, making a movie, making a you know, a feature or short or whatever it is, just being realistic about what you can do from a technical and creative stance. And if you, like I think I've mentioned before, if you embrace it and if you know, okay, we're not going to have, you know, some, it's not going to look like, you know, we had, you know, these huge explosions in the background and, you know, we just had all this money to throw at, you know, what was going on screen. And if you write a script and if you plan it all out in a way that takes advantage of the low budget, you can do some really, really good stuff that doesn't take nearly as much time and money.
Well, and that's one of the things that I think Robert Rodriguez does do, is he does do a lot of pre-planning. If you look at the behind the scenes on, you know, Desperado or anything that else that he's done, you see this tremendous amount of pre-planning that he does, where he goes in and he literally shoots, you know, the scene, and he'll shoot, he'll do this funny thing too sometimes where he'll shoot like half of a room and then, you know, comp the other side in so that the room looks bigger and all of these other different things.
Yeah, he's thrifty and so he's clever. And right. I mean, that is a point that, I mean, that is the point. You have to, if you don't have money and time to throw away on something, then you need to be really smart about planning to get around that.
So the last thing I want to ask everyone is, the number one question that I get asked is, what software do you use? What camera do you use? What hardware do you use? It's this sort of material goods question. And it sounds like everyone here uses something different. You know, the Diary of the Dead film sounds like it was shot for nothing on a DVX. I don't know what you edited that in, but...
we edited in Sony Vegas, actually.
Oh, okay. Yeah, so it's really... But that is literally, if I had to pinpoint the number one question that I get asked, it's what camera, what's, you know, it's just what tools, what does your pipeline look like? Maybe that's the best way to summarize it.
And I think a lot of the times the people asking that question, I think they don't realize that the real art of filmmaking and all that, it's not in the software. They think that there's some magic tricks that they just don't have access to yet. And it's not, it's just, you know, doing it and learning the tricks and all that sort of, you know, just that sort of like gut internal knowledge that, and that's, you know, I know I and probably everyone else is in that same place at some point where they're, you know, as they're kind of getting into it, they don't know what it takes to make that. And they think that it's the technology that's limiting them as opposed to all this, you know, myriad of other things that they have to kind of get under their belts first.
Yeah, and I'm curious about, I mean, one thing I'd like to ask is, with Pigeon Impossible, you said you've been working on that for 4 years. Has Soft Image even been around for 4 years? I didn't think.
I started in that.
But in the same, the same quality? Because, I mean, frankly, 4 years ago, I never heard about it.
I mean, yeah, Soft has been around for a long time.
Yeah.
Yeah, Soft 3D has been around for a very long time. I started off, it was XSI version 5.1, I think, when I started. So, yeah, it's been around for quite a while. It's definitely kind of more come into its own lately, especially with ICE and, you know, some of the different technologies that they've released just in the last couple of months here. But
yeah, for me, I'd heard about Cinema 4D and, you know, Lightwave and things like that, but I just never heard of Soft before. But then again, you know, again,
Soft kind of dropped off the. So. I mean, they kind of dropped off the radar. There was a space race going on between, what now became Autodesk Maya, but that team between them and Soft Image in the late 90s, there was sort of this. I call it a space race because they were, you know, trying to build the killer 3D app, and. I don't know, Soft Image ran into a little bit more trouble at that point, I think, than, you know, what ended up being Maya then came out and then became somewhat dominant.
So do you find, Mark, that the tools actually matter that much, or do you find that the information in your head is transferable? Because
I'm going to be a contrarian and say the tools do matter. I'm actually going to just go ahead and say that. I think you need to find tools that help you solve a problem. Now, in terms of cameras, I mean, this year I've worked on a bunch of projects that used, well, let's see, the highest end camera I think I've worked with this year was an F950. But other than that, I did a subsequent project where we used an EX1 as if it were a 950, which you can do by using the HDMI out and recording direct to a workstation. And we did that. And honestly, I did not particularly notice the difference when I had the key footage, which was pretty amazing. And then lately, right now, I'm working with some red footage, and that stuff is, you know, like butter. I mean, it's a dream, really. Right. That is the post-production camera. But does that mean you should go buy a red camera so that, you know, you'll be a huge success? Of course not. Not only that, red could actually inhibit the process that I'm talking about, which is the problem-solving process. Now, if you're shooting, the problem-solving process is mostly about how do I set it up? How do I handle the camera? How do I get what I want in that lens? To a certain extent, it's also about how do I make it look really great, but I'd say that's maybe 20% of it. 80% of it is how do I compose shots and get sound and get lighting and get all this stuff so that it just isn't miserably bad. On the software side, I mean, I and certain others gravitate toward After Effects. Other people gravitate toward Flame as sort of the go-to place to actually just figure stuff out. Not only get, you know, task A or B done, which there's plenty of different software that can allow you to do that. And once you know how to do it, you can transfer those skills from one software to another. But to just sit there with something and go, wow, how am I going to do this? Like, right, to actually face that blank page kind of creative challenge or technical challenge. Sometimes it's just like, wow, I actually have to get this to something like that. And I'm just not sure yet how it's going to go.
Yeah, and for me, I tend to problem solve. I was a shaker, so I tend to problem solve in Nuke now because it just feels, you know, I like nodal compositing. I like the way that it works. It just feels right for me. But Nuke is kind of cost prohibitive to a lot of people. I mean, I don't know what a Nuke license costs, but it's $5,000 or something.
Well, see, and like for me, Nuke and Shake don't fit the bill as well. And actually, it's too bad we don't have Stu on the show because we could gang up on you a little bit on this. But
well, he uses both in his pipeline now.
Uses Nuke, both, yes.
Nuke and After
uses
Effects.
Both, sure. As and I would advocate the same. Yeah. You know, but to actually, what I'm talking about is that tool that lets you really, and you know, it's a matter of taste to a certain extent too. I'm sure there are people out there who would defend, you know, Shake for doing this. Shake is certainly logical, but there's a lot of types of shots that I would not try to problem solve in that way in Shake. I would want to go into Shake knowing what I want to do more. So that would be an interesting argument to have with somebody, because I think probably in the end, anybody could defend their tool set, and it might even just come down to personal taste. But it does seem like in this particular area, Flame and After Effects seem to often be the go-to tools for people who just are trying to think through a difficult shot that involves some mixture of animation, compositing, you know, some kind of effects.
Yeah, well, I'm going to say one thing. If you are just one guy trying to get something done, just use After Effects. Just stick with one tool. Because here's the reason is that because After Effects can do so many more things than just compositing and building a shot and that kind of stuff. I mean, right, it is really the Swiss Army knife of motion graphics and just getting whatever you need done. I mean, we've even used for, you know, resizing footage from one thing to another, or you know, messing, taking footage and just making it destroyed looking.
Yeah, I mean, I do stuff in there that it's not technically supposed to do, like camera mapping. You know, that's not a built-in feature.
Well, I do stuff like that in Nuke, but I think
Nuke has it built in.
But
Nuke actually makes it a lot easier for
you. But camera mapping is totally possible in After Effects. You know, and from a cost point of view, you know, it's very accessible to the indie filmmaker.
Well, that's what I was going to say. I mean, the thing that After Effects has that is, you know, as far as that kind of tool in its favor is it's not very expensive, and it has a familiar interface in the sense that it's timeline based, and you don't have to learn an entirely new skill set.
I would actually argue in many ways it's harder to use than Nuke. To be honest, I think that Nuke and Shake have the perception that they're high end and they're for the complicated stuff, and After Effects is for, you know, Joe.
Oh, I don't have that perception. I'm just saying that it's timeline based, and a lot of people.
I mean, I actually hold this against After Effects.
Oh, I see.
It's sometimes because it can do a larger set of stuff. Like, you wouldn't want to be timing, you know, choreographing type in Shake, or even anything that involves a lot of elements coming in and out of frame. It just would quickly drive you completely insane. And so the fact that there's a provision to do that, but there's also the provision to just do standard straight up comping. Well, the straight up comping is, to be honest, it involves more steps in After Effects. It's actually less straightforward.
Yeah, my general rule of thumb is whenever it comes to compositing like visual effects or like heavy 3D stuff, I use Shake now, but I used Combustion before, but yeah. I still got a copy of After Effects and I do a ton of stuff in that. And yeah, I think a lot of it just comes down to, like we were talking before, you know, it's that knowing what packages have their strengths and knowing how to use them in different ways that makes it possible to do all that stuff. It's not so much the package itself.
Well, and get your hands on it and see how it feels to
use
it.
Yeah, you gotta play around with it.
Well, and I was going to say that the fact that we're all actually able to have a conversation about Nuke, Combustion, After Effects, Shake, you know, that tells me that there is a skill set required. Because, I mean, I've used Combustion and Flame, and I've used all these different tools, and I do have a preference for certain things, but that sounds like a skill set that I have, not a skill set that the tool brings to the table.
Right. Well, I'm going to add one other thing in that I've never had my hands on Nuke or Flame or, you know, these other tools just because they've been cost prohibitive and I don't want to steal them and I don't want to use them, you know, in a production environment where I can't afford to use them. So, you know, by default, because of the fact that I'm doing something for $1,500, yeah. you know, in a 4-day turn, or $35,000, you know, on a five week, whatever, I just got to use tools that are cheap. And especially if I have more than one artist that's working for me, you know, there's a difference between buying something that's $700 and something that's $5,000.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the other thing too is most people go out and buy Final Cut Studio yeah. and I just kind of, as a filmmaker, and I just, it's like Vegas, right? I just kind of stare at them and go, wow, this is more tool than you know how to handle right now. I mean, like the very notion of you moving to something like After Effects, when you know 90% of what you want to do, you can do in Final Cut, or you could do in Motion, and you don't have to learn some other tool because frankly, the stuff you're doing is not that complicated.
Right. Well, especially
but it still helps to learn it on those other because that's where you really develop that skill set. You know, by doing even a simple
right.
You know, even doing a simple composite and shake is going to teach you so much about compositing because you have to know how to deal with pre-multiplication and all these other, you know, just esoteric things that you
yeah,
wouldn't
stuff
encounter.
Not gonna sorry, I'm stepping on you, but stuff that's yeah, not no, going to help the editorial at all. I'm learning a whole bunch of stuff that I don't really need to know. And if I use the same thing in After Effects, you know, there's the keyer and I click and I'm done. You know, and I'm 90% of the way there without having to worry about this stuff.
Well, I've seen, I guess my point is, I've seen people make some really damn good films without ever leaving Final Cut Studio.
True.
I mean, where you have, you know, gunfire and color correction. You have all these different things going on, and they never really left Final Cut Studio, not once to yeah. do it.
I've done it.
I don't know what Final Cut Studio costs anymore. $1,200?
$1,295.
Yeah, $1,200 for the full thing. But that's DVD Studio Pro and everything. But
yeah,
I know I've actually done serious color correction in Final Cut before, you know, just with a three-way color corrector. Because I've when I was at that post company, we had an EQ, which that's a Quantel. That's a very expensive, I don't know what it is. It's like $500,000 or something
right.
for the system. But still, it comes down to it's your most 90% of all your color correction stuff, it's still just highs, mids, lows, contrast, saturation. No, it's the basic stuff. It's very rare that you have to, you know, pull keys and do all that other stuff. So there's, you know, oh, and the other thing I was going to mention, open source stuff. There's, you know, like, especially for like, I know I've played around with Blender a little bit, GIMP, as far as, you know, doing Photoshop type stuff. I've got a copy of that just because I don't want to, you know, buy two copies of Photoshop. But there's some serious stuff that gets done in open source. And it's, yeah, it's still totally valid.
Yeah, it's funny. Okay. I color corrected a couple of films using Scratch, and I color corrected one on a DaVinci, and then I color corrected one with Magic Bullet Looks. And the one that I color corrected in Final Cut using Magic Bullet Looks, you know, Stu wrote about it, and then the thing went to 21 festivals, and it won Audience Award at 10 and first place at 11 of them. And it was color corrected in Magic Bullet Looks, of all things. So it really, yep. that just tells you the tool isn't really the limiting factor.
Right. Like when I made my feature film Forever, I had no idea about like 32-bit, you know, 32 bits per channel and all that stuff. I just color corrected in Sony Vegas using curves and desaturation. So, and then, you know, that film went on to win an audience award at Long Island Big Fish Film Festival. And I got a lot of comments about, oh, you know, this actually looks like a real movie, you know, and I guess that has to do with the composition and stuff, but like the color really helped because it was like a bleach bypass look. So it's just funny because it's not really about, I don't really think it's really about the tools at all. It's just, you know, whatever you feel comfortable with using.
I was going to bring up 32-bit HDR, and then I'm glad you did, actually, because that's a great example of something that's just so straightforward in Nuke and so convoluted and complicated in certain other tools that we could talk about, if it's even available in other tools. So, you know, these new technologies come along, and they're actually, you know, sometimes they're more complicated in... I'm not making a very profound point here, but it's a good example of something that is just, you almost don't have to quote unquote learn it in Nuke. I mean, you have to understand how it works, but it doesn't actually, it is just the way to work in that app.
Well, I think kind of what you're saying is kind of like what we were talking about, like the difference between After Effects and Shake before, whereas After Effects is they're trying hard to be more user friendly, whereas things like Shake and, you know, some of the other more expensive compositors, they know that they're catering to a pro market who, mm-hmm. or, you know, a pro user who already knows what pre-multiplication and, you know, how to work in a linear color space and all this sort of stuff.
And wants full control over it. Yeah, that's right.
Exactly. So they give you that full control right out of the gate, whereas After Effects, sometimes, I know several times I've had to work around After Effects things just because I was trying to do something that was, you know, a little bit above what it expects the user to want to be able to do.
Yep.
Interesting. So I guess as we fade off into the sunset, the other question is sort of the same answer, which is like the camera. I mean, I know that many things have been shot on many different cameras, and I see John Foster wanting to make some comment about how important the camera you use is.
I don't own a camera.
That seems important.
I don't own a camera. That's really huge because what that does is it gets me the ability to have in my pipeline whatever camera is going to work best. You know, I'm not going to say, oh, I'm going to own this, and I'm going to try to make it do this over here, and I'm going to try to make it do this over here, and I don't want to be pigeonholed that way.
Yeah, I do the same thing. I have a little Canon EF10 or F whatever the heck it's called, and I use that for just grabbing some shots and kind of prevising stuff. But when it comes to actually shooting, I tend to try and get the right camera for the right job.
But it's, you know, like everyone when I was teaching at the college, everyone was like, what camera should I get? I'm like, don't get a camera. Then they'd show up with, you know, the whatever that all their friends were buying. I'm like, why did you spend $4,000 on that camera? They're like, well, because, you know, I need it. I'm like, no, you don't. What you need to do is put that $4,000 into doing what you need to do, like buying a new computer or having all your software or making your movie and borrowing your friend's camera who paid $4,000 for the camera and make him the DP.
There is an advantage, though, of owning your own camera. I mean, you could just, if, you know, you see a sunset or, you know, or something, you know, anything comes along that you know, you can throw in your film, you could just pull out your camera and start shooting.
Right. You can practice shooting as well, yeah.
Which is why I have a smaller Canon that I'm talking about and not the, you know, and there's a great, the HV20 is a great example of that. I mean, that thing is sub $600 right now. You don't need to spend, you know, $10,000 on a camera for the kind of things we're talking about.
Well, to a certain extent, though, a camera like that is going to work against shooting cinematically. I mean, it doesn't really, you know, you're not going to get shallow cinematic depth of field. You're not going to get some of the dynamic range of other cameras. And that's the kind of stuff people get stuck on. But if that prevented you from shooting at all, then obviously, you know, for that extra 10 or 20% of cinematic quality, you're missing the first, you know, majority of it.
Well, do we think that matters, though? I mean, you know, I'm hearing Paul say that he shot something that won the Diary of the Dead competition on a DVX. I mean, that's, you talk about range. I mean, the Canon HV20 has far better
I think it just goes back to whether you're in the Rodriguez school or the Kubrick Ridley Scott school. Because, I mean, if you're really about making a very cinematographic movie, then you better do better than that. But if you are telling a story and want to pick up a camera and make that thing happen, and you want a nice, clear image and where you can see stuff, you know, there's lots of valid choices. Especially, I mean, close-up faces, surprisingly, if you have a movie that's really about actors and what they're doing, we're really forgiving about how faces look in many ways. I mean, we're not, there's certain things we're not forgiving about that, but most media are oriented toward that. Even old black and white television, the whole way it was optimized was just so faces would look good on screen, and so television was always about faces.
Right. Interesting.
I will say that while I don't own a camera, I've used every opportunity to get my hands on other cameras. And it's always been the idea of, you know, once I get to a camera, I already know how to use it. I already know how to frame my shot. I already know how to think about what's in front of the lens. And so I'm basically not wasting my own time trying to figure out what I'm supposed to do compositionally when I'm trying to muck with the camera to get the settings correct.
Interesting.
And well, a lot of people, I think, they, you know, I hear a lot of people going, well, I'm going to wait to shoot my film until The Scarlet comes out. Mm-hmm. And that's horrible.
Yeah, that's pretty deadly, isn't it?
You know, yeah, you could just pick up a camera right now and make it. And, you know, let's say I didn't make the Diary of the Dead film, which almost didn't happen because it snowed, and Dave was trying to, you know, he was like, well, I don't know if we should, you know, what do you want to do with all this snow? And I kind of, you know, made up some BS where I was like, oh, you ever see a zombie movie in the snow? No. So let's just go out and shoot it. It's like, what if we didn't? Yes. So like, what if we didn't shoot the Diary of the Dead film that we, you know, then we never would have won. And if, you know, and then we would have wondered like, oh, well, you know, some of the other films, maybe we would have felt like, oh, we could have done better than that. But we never would have known what the outcome would have been if we didn't go out and just shoot it. So, you know, I think like, you know, waiting for like a camera or waiting for something to happen, you know, before you shoot your film is definitely a bad idea.
You know, it's also worth saying there's so many things out there that will sink your shot besides your camera. I mean, you could have a great rig. It's the same with anything, you know, and then mm-hmm. get out there and like you're 20 minutes too late and you're losing the light and you're trying to get the shot in a case where it doesn't matter what you're shooting with.
Where's
you've lost
my
the light.
Latte? I want my I'm not doing this shot until I get my latte. And that girl is ruining your shot because she doesn't have her latte, and the PA is late, stuck in traffic. And by the time it gets there, it's cold. And now she's bitchy. And
so once again, it's about craft services.
It is.
Well, yeah, I'll tell a story, and then you know, we could talk about this forever. But my quick funny little anecdote is on the feature film that I was doing. We shot it on the JVC GY series HD camera. They're basically like 720p kind of Vericams, but. We had three of them running at all times, and we had this great actress, and she was really pretty well known. And we had she was supposed to shoot herself in a hotel room in Vegas, right? And we had a gun specialist come in and say, this is how you would use a gun and all that. And we had obviously we didn't have real guns. We had props, but they were the same exact size and weight, and they had all that. And when it came down to it, she refused to put the gun under her chin and shoot herself. Because the guy had just kept telling her, like, you can't treat a gun like this. You know, we had this gun specialist, like, you can't do this with a gun. You would never do this with a gun. This is totally, you know, out of control.
And so should have had the psychopath trainer.
Yeah, I know. I totally wanted to. But I wanted the entire crew to be familiar with a gun so that they didn't shoot. You know, they didn't turn the gun sideways and shoot all, like, you know, gangster-style BS movie, you know. So I wanted them to be really familiar with, here's how you load a gun, here's what it looks like, here's how it feels, here's how you pull it out, you know, everything. So, you know, it's absolute realism, but then she just flaked out. So we ended up getting another actress who didn't have any of the training, right? And so the way she held the gun was completely ridiculous, so we had to, like, spend all this time training her. And I don't know, it was literally this one scene that, by the way, ended up getting cut out of the film. But it was this one scene that I spent like, you know, two or three actresses on and, I don't know, 6 days of shooting on.
Right. And so the discipline
for one damn scene that had nothing to do with anything.
Right. So learning how to actually get your crew in there and get the shot you want before other factors have totally sunk you is going to yield more better shots than waiting for the right camera and then just...
You probably had the perfect camera.
Well, and also just being good about rolling with it. You know, when you're on a set, it's such a, I'm trying to think of a good word. It's just got such momentum to it that half of the battle is just getting what you can get when you get it and just owning it. you know, not trying to make it something that it's not, and just being able to sort of think on the fly and, you know, change stuff as you have to. That's a huge part of it.
Well, and as Mark would say, that was my Kubrick moment. 14 hours of footage I never even used with three different actresses two different locations.
You should spend a year on
it. But you got a story out of it.
But so. I got a great story, and I learned a heck of a lot about it. So I'm sure we could talk about this all day, guys. This has been a great show. I'm tempted to ask a couple of you guys who haven't been on the show before where people can find you. So let me do that. Mark Christensen, where can people find out more about the great tome of Christensen?
Well, it's bad timing for finding out about the next tome, but let's just, how about Twitter? I like Twitter these days, so find me at Flowseeker on Twitter.
And if you followed him while this show was going on, you might have noticed that he called it contemplative and suggested that he should pick a fight, which he seemed to do. So that's pretty awesome. Lucas, aside from Pigeon Impossible, is there some place that people can find you or something you would like to talk about?
No, I think that's the best place. I've got my email and stuff on there. So if you go to the main site, you can, you know, just go to contact and there's a place people can email me. And I am on Twitter. I think Lucas Martell is my handle. It's very, very ingenious.
Yeah, I think you post once every 4 days or something.
Twitter just sort of scares me. It happens too fast. And I, you know, me and my still 1970s ways, I can't quite keep up with all of the fast pace that the kids are moving at these days. So,
yeah, you got to just bathe in the stream and know that you're going to miss most of it. And then Paul, where's the best place for people to find you?
I have a bunch. Let me just throw them out real quick. One is www.triple-e-productions.net. Okay. And then I also have a blog, which is www.pauldvblog.com. And then MySpace, it's just myspace.com/pauldv. And Twitter, you can find all that stuff on my MySpace or on my blog.
Yeah, you're Paul DV on Twitter. I've been communicating with you for some time on there.
Yep.
Well, excellent. Thanks, everyone. Great discussion. Really appreciate it. And for everyone listening, stay tuned next week for a This Week in Media, where we return to our normal schedule and programming. Thanks so much. Bye-bye.